From the land to Grant University in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois, this is the Closing Market Report. It's the fifth day of June 2023. I'm Illinois Extension's Tuck Gleason out of the office, so no update of the commodity markets this afternoon. However, we will hear from the Farm Doc webinar that took place just after the team returned in mid-May from a trip to Brazil. There are many questions once they finished up, and we'll hear those questions from the audience that was participating live in that webinar. And we'll also today hear from Nick Sider. He's the Field Crops Extension Entomologist based here on the Urbana-Champaign campus of the University of Illinois. On Friday, he talked to us about the black cutworm and cutting that can be taking place right now. And today, we'll hear about the western corn rootworm and its emergence. He left us some notes about what happens and how that takes place and what you should look for in the field. And we'll do all of that on this Monday edition of the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media. It is public radio for the farming world.
Todd Gleason's services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
We'll begin today with the western corn rootworm. Historically, this insect pest causes more damage to the corn crop in the United States than any other, and it is costly to control. That's been done genetically over the last couple of decades using BT traits in corn seeds. However, those traits have begun to break, and there's more concern about the western and even the northern corn rootworm in the state of Illinois. Nick Sider, of course, is an Extension field crops entomologist here on the Urbana-Champaign campus of the University of Illinois, and says that it is important that producers and those scouting fields across the state pay attention to the rootworm hatch that takes place. It should be, according to the growing degree days, about 50% complete now, depending on where you are in the state. And that, of course, is temperature related or growing degree day related. And Nick explains how it works.
So insect development is driven by temperature, based on temperature accumulation. And based on the number of degree days we've accumulated so far, we can predict that rootworm egg hatch has begun, and that will be roughly at 50% egg hatch, at least in Champaign County, and we're similar throughout much of the state. And that's pretty typical. Around the first week of June, last week of May, that's usually when that occurs.
Now, if you don't want to use the growing degree days to figure the rootworm hatch, there are other ways to eyeball it, says Sider.
Fireflies are actually on a similar developmental schedule. And so when you start to see fireflies, the firefly adults out in your yard, you'll know that rootworm egg hatch is beginning as well. So kind of an interesting relationship there.
And one that farmers and producers and others that are scouting cornfields should pay attention to, whether it's the growing degree days or just the eyeball method with the fireflies, because rootworm hatch makes a difference in the way they watch, prepare, and respond to the western corn rootworm.
So with rootworm, of course, all the effective controls that we have are applied at planting. So it's too late to actually do anything about it right now. However, when we hit that rootworm egg hatch, that's kind of our indication that we can start looking in the soil and start looking for those rootworm larvae over the next few weeks to get a feel for how bad of a problem we have, how effective our controls were. And if we're seeing any resistance, for instance, if we're using a BT trait, we can start to evaluate that by looking for larvae over the next few weeks. Of course, the best evaluation that you're going to get on control effectiveness for rootworm is actually by digging those roots up sometime around or after tasseling, on into the reproductive stages if you can. And examining them for rootworm feeding. That's how we're going to get the best evaluation of how well our controls actually did.
That's Nick Sider. He's an Extension field crops entomologist here on the Urbana-Champaign campus of the University of Illinois. We'll be talking with him throughout the growing season here on Illinois Public Media's Closing Market Report. Check in each and every day to see if there's something new with the insect pest in your fields. If you were listening to this program in the early part of May, you know for 12 days the FarmDoc team traveled across Brazil. The team members that were participating in that particular trip included Gary Schnitke, Nick Paulson, ag economist from the U of I, along with research assistant Joanna Calusi, who is a native of Brazil and put the trip together, and agricultural communications professor Eric Morgan. All four, once they returned, hosted a webinar on the 18th day of May and closed out that webinar by taking questions from those who were participating on the other end, those watching the webinar. They sent in questions, and I thought you might find it of interest to hear what the audience had to say about this FarmDoc trip and the questions they were asking. The first one was about politics and the difference between the previous and current administrations. That would be the out-of-office President Bolsonaro and the again in office for the second time, Lula da Silva. Joanna Calusi fielded that first question.
Yes, most of the agribusiness sector, they supported Bolsonaro. He still has some uncomfortable from the agribusiness sector with Lula. But so far, we didn't see any change in the Lula's government regarding agriculture. There is a huge concern about what could happen, but so far it's just concern.
Let's talk a little bit about logistics as well. We had some questions about BR-163. That's the road that runs from one end of south end of Brazil to the north end, from one port to the other. I'm not quite certain it makes it all the way to the southern ports, but close enough that it's used as the soybean highway. It was not paved. I think it finally got paved completely in the last 5 years, maybe the last decade, but certainly in the mid-2000s, most of it was not paved at that point. The governor of Lero Maggi ran and won, I think, on the idea that we would pave our way out of Mato Grosso, that has happened. So the question really is about logistics and what are the expectations going forward. We got a couple of those. Will the roads continue to be paved? What is railway like, and how are they building out infrastructure in general? And I don't know who among you wants to take that up to begin with.
Yeah, and there are a number of improvements that aren't on the books that they know about.
This is Gary Schnitke.
One of them is just making that two-lane highway a four-lane, which would considerably help things. That was in the works, then got shut down, and you would think that that would happen fairly soon. Just as an aside, while we were on that highway, there were two wrecks that we saw, one coming towards us and then one we got caught up in, and we took some dirt roads around that. There is also the development of rails, and those are primarily going to the southern port, and that was going more or less through Sao Paulo, but that would also cut down the highway portion of that. And again, the northern ports, the development of those northern ports are going to be key. I don't see how you can have an agriculture that large and that not happen. And they're still growing, and it is just going to get better. So, and everybody knows that there, but there are political challenges. The other thing that was mentioned a number of times was that where the U.S. has an advantage over Brazil is in infrastructure. We invested in infrastructure in the United States. Brazil is not so much, and on our education system.
Eric Morgan, the communications specialist, picks up here.
And just to paint that picture a little bit more, it's kind of interesting. If you think about BR-163, the two-lane highway, and you know, as it goes through Mato Grosso. Mato Grosso is a state that is 1.5 times bigger than Texas, right? And so that is just one road. Now, granted, it goes through the primary grain production region, but there's grain production all over the state. And so those roads deteriorate significantly outside of that. We actually traveled from Goiânia, which is the capital of Goiás, the state, to Cocalinho, which was about 400 kilometers. Is that correct, Joanna?
Yeah.
And maybe 100 kilometers were on a dirt road that was rough. I mean, we were bounced around and got plenty of it. And you know, you can imagine that during harvest time, that's the majority of the road system. So again, as the improvements continue, and they are continuing with these investments, you know, the situation will ease a little bit.
On the Amazon, I know Cargill and ADM both have facilities, port facilities on the Amazon itself. I think, Joanna, you've told me that it is an Atlantic Coast port on the north side that is the biggest of the ports there. Those are all investments made by outside firms. Is the issue that they'll have going forward that they need to develop infrastructure nationally so that the domestic numbers have to be developed and that ports and other things that can be put in by companies has not been the issue at this point?
Yes, most of the investments that Brazil had in the last years was from private company, big traders, I think. And the last government, they changed some rules looking to avoid this kind of investments in barges and in railroads and roads as well.
And one last infrastructure question that just came in that we should address. How much investment has China made in infrastructure? For instance, we talked on the radio for many years about China investing in railways, but that doesn't seem to have come to fruition.
There is investment from China, for sure, in Brazil, in infrastructure, but I don't know how percentage that represents.
Gary, any insights about regarding the land cost there versus here and marketing equilibriums?
Yeah, just they have much lower land costs than we do here. The Farron Group mentioned that they thought when we did the comparisons, they had roughly half the land costs that we have in the United States. That advantage for them is going, that's an advantage for Mato Grosso. That is going to go away because as their land becomes they have less pasture to bring on board, they're going to have rising land costs. And in fact, a number of the farmers in Mato Grosso realize that and they're moving out their operations to the Matopiba area in Brazil and Colombia. So they have less land, they have less cash rent than we do here. And that is their primary cost advantage. And there's also a question, can Illinois and U.S. compete? Yes, they can. If you look at like fertilizer, seed, and chemicals, we're roughly the same cost. We pay more in seed for soybean production, less in fertilizer, and less in pesticides. If you look at what their labor situation looks like, they have roughly one employee per 200 acres, which is wouldn't work here. So if anything, but their labor costs are totally different. So yes, the United States can compete, but we have to realize that we have to figure out we have to figure out ways to make that competition to our advantage, to our strengths. And yeah, we can compete with Brazil, but Brazil is going to keep growing. So that's just something to keep in mind if we compete and can compete or not.
Steve Sanka, a former ag economist, along with you, had a comment and a question both, noting that 20 years ago, the way to become a farmer was to, and be successful, was to purchase, to have the land. He's wondering whether that's changed today and that the ratio switched with farming being run as a business rather than just how much land you're able to get hold of.
Yeah, I 20 years ago, you tried to acquire as much land as you could. They still have less land costs than we do here, but that ticket is over in Mato Grosso, or coming to a rapid end. And yes, they have to act more like a business. In fact, as I was looking at their cost structure, I was thinking we should send some Illinois farmers down there and have them squeak out some lower costs. But they have scale that we don't. But that scale happened because it developed in the 1940s and, or excuse me, 1940s in São Paulo and 1980s and 1990s in Mato Grosso. And just think if you had Illinois And nothing here in the 1980s and 1990s, nothing, absolutely, you know, some pasture land, what Illinois would look like now.
Do we know what percentage of farmland might be foreign owned in Brazil?
Oh, there is a restrictions to buy land for international people. It is possible, but with a partnership with Brazilians. So there is, of course, investment, but it's not most of the. It's a few amount because these restrictions in legislation.
Nick, you made note about the payment system being on sacks of grain for rented land because they could depend on being able to raise a crop. I would think that might be on first crop only as opposed to second crop. And Daryl Good noted that years ago as they were coming, as they were beginning to play on the international stage, that they didn't have that much variability. The question, however, is does that provide any insight into Brazil versus U.S. supplies and elasticities?
You know, the lack of, especially when you look at any sort of aggregate production level, you go from the farm to the state level to the country level. I think production is very stable, particularly nationwide when you look at Brazil. So
this is agricultural economist Nick Paulson.
That would definitely impact supply elasticities. Although, the other thing they have to keep in mind about Brazil, because they have two crops in the season, is they can be pretty nimble in reacting to changing market conditions. Most of the farms are focused on growing soybeans in the wet season and then either cotton or corn in the dry season, but they have other crop rotations that they can mix in, which, you know, gives them twice as many chances during any given calendar year to adapt to changing market conditions compared with farmers in the U.S.
Joanna, can you remind us in how much of second crop corn Mato Grosso produces? And then I'm going to put that into another question, which is online. How important is corn-based ethanol to the long-term outlook for Brazilians' second crop corn? And one other context, in 2009, the governor of Brazil was here on campus, and what they wanted to do was to go visit an ethanol plant at that time, because their expectation was to build out ethanol plants there.
Yeah, today Mato Grosso represents more than 30% of the corn production in Brazil. Just remember, Safrinha is more than 75% of the corn production today, the second crop. The first industry that used just corn for produce ethanol was in 2017, so 5-6 years ago. So it's very recent.
On the biologicals, Gary, were they widely adopted across every farm you were at, or just at the last farm?
I think that was just the last farm. We didn't specifically ask about biologicals at the other farm. So that was Schaefer's group. That was their emphasis, and they were working that. And by the way, they work. They're into regenerative agriculture, but they want a return on investment in that. By the way, so they're looking at it in that sort of framework.
I think that's really important. Gary's point there was, that Schaefer group, they were, Gary mentioned the cost differences. They were talking about having to spray the soybean crop 7 times for pests. It's a tropical climate, and so the incentives to be able to reduce their chemical use through mm-hmm. biologics is much higher from a profit perspective. And then they also have sort of the potential opportunity as they develop these to potentially commercialize things in their partnership with Syngenta. They're not ruling out the potential for carbon markets or other sustainability opportunities to arise in Brazil. They're not there yet. They're further behind even where we are here in the US. But I would say that's just sort of a bonus. The motivation was definitely on just being able to reduce chemical use for cost control.
Did they mention, was it Asian soybean rust that they were still trying to control? Do you recall?
It was definitely fungicide.
It was probably Asian soybean rust, which came into that nation from Africa, and that we had large concerns here in the U.S. So right at the turn of the century, in 2000.
But by the way, there's a national law that you can't plant soybeans from until September 15th. And I don't know what the ending date of that is to control items. So,
yeah. And Gary, the difference, and I think you and I talked about this, just so those here in the United States, we do get Asian soybean rust. It generally doesn't get
Up here.
It does, but it doesn't get up here until late in the season. It doesn't survive very well, other than right along the coastline. So 15 degrees.
There is an advantage of having a frost.
Yeah. Yes. But my question was, how important is it that the agricultural world was able to develop soybean and corn that could be grown in these tropical regions?
Yeah, absolutely. That was an absolutely crucial development. And Embrapa was Brazilian, and Joanna can wax poetically about that group, was key in that. And the major nationals also saw the opportunity in that part of the world. They saw the demand, they saw China, and we have what we have. So, but yes, developing soybeans and corn to grow in a tropical climate is a game changer.
One last question. For these large farms, how did ag tech platform tools in terms of insights, recommendations, and operational tracking come into play?
That's a huge deal for them. And they were using that to track more or less where their equipment was. And again, you got to remember that January and February period is absolutely critical. You have rains every day someplace, and you have to find a dry field. And so that's what, and get everybody there.
Well, and even things as simple as, repairs, the ability to be connected and take a picture of the problem and send it somewhere rather than potentially driving an hour or more and realizing you don't have the right tool or the right part, and then having to go an hour or more back. And time is of the essence when they're busy with field operations. And so the connectedness is a lot of bells and whistles, but a lot of kind of just basic operational efficiency stuff too, that's important for.
That was an excerpt of a webinar that the FarmDoc team put on. You can find it in the archives at farmdocdaily.illinois.edu. You've been listening to the Closing Market Report.